Hey, everyone. It is Friday, March 8th. You're listening to the Mo News Podcast. I'm Moshe Wanunu.
And I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts.
And where we read all the news and read between the lines so you do not have to. Jill, I'd like to wish you a happy International Women's Day today.
Thank you very much, Moshe. I appreciate it.
You're our resident international woman here. It is a big day. There will be demonstrations and a whole bunch of ways people are marking this around the world. It's been a holiday now since 1977, officially based on the UN, a global celebration of the economic, social, political achievements for women, as well as a way to push governments to do more when it comes to equal pay, access to healthcare, etc. It actually is an official holiday in about 24 countries around the world.
Also happening this weekend, we want to mention daylight saving time starts at 2 a.m. on Sunday morning. So that's March 10th. But usually people switch the clocks back before they go to bed on Saturday night. I mean, or switch the clocks forward in this case.
Are there clocks to switch anymore, Jill? I feel like the computers. Like, there's always a handful. Actually, there's always there's a clock in our bedroom that my wife is always like, Mosh, like a couple of weeks from now, she'll be like, why have you not switched it yet? So it is a good reminder to myself to push that clock ahead. And a couple of things to note here, Jill, you pronounced it correctly. It is daylight saving time. Many people like to call it savings time, but if we're being accurate here, it is saving time. And many of you are always asking, what happened to that legislation to make saving time permanent in Congress? It's not going anywhere, folks. In fact, it was sort of mistakenly pushed ahead, never signed into law, didn't even get passed by the House, just by the Senate. And many people don't even remember, but we tried it about 40 years ago in the 70s, and it went so poorly. The country went to permanent daylight saving time that they reversed it 18 months later. It happened during the Nixon Ford years back then, because the upside, it's really light late. The downside in the winter, sunrise doesn't happen in some areas till after 9 a.m. So that became the big issue there.
Really quickly, Moshe, have you done anything to prep Olivia for daylight saving time beginning?
No, Jill, I have not, because she is 5 months old and sleep is still sort of all over the place. But tell me, should I have been doing something at this juncture?
Well, they, aka the experts or sleep experts here, say that you should adjust the sleep time by about 15 minutes a night leading up to the clocks changing. And then by the time you do it, the kids are already on schedule. But we haven't done it in my house. And I don't know. I felt like that's something Alex would be on top of. Your wife.
Well, your kids are slightly older. And I think that like we're still at the point where like we don't have a hard set bedtime every night. It's still
right.
It falls anywhere between, I don't know, 6 and 9 p.m., depending on how the naps went. I mean, we're still at sort of 3 naps a day. So it's still a little bit scattershot. So even like that level of precision, 15 minutes, we're not there yet. But I'll let you know how it goes on Monday's pod.
Yeah, getting my daughter to school on Monday is going to be interesting. All right, let's get to some headlines here. President Biden delivers his State of the Union address to the nation, trying to make his case to Americans that he deserves a second term. To the Middle East, the U.S. is set to build a temporary port to get aid into Gaza, plus the status of the ceasefire talks. A House panel has approved a plan to ban TikTok, but is it going to happen? IVF services return to several Alabama clinics after that new law is made official. In health news, Asian American women are getting lung cancer despite never smoking. What's going on? A conviction in the case of that on-set shooting, The Armorer, on the Alec Baldwin film, now facing 18 months in prison. And it's almost Oscar time, where to watch, and the predictions for who could win. Plus, it is Friday. Cheers to the freaking weekend, what we are watching, reading, and eating. Okay, let's start with President Biden's State of the Union address. A lot on the line as he tries to convince Americans to give him a second term in the White House. He had a populist message when talking about the economy, looking to appeal to younger voters. He is calling for higher taxes on corporations and the wealthy, saying households worth more than $100 million should pay at least 25% of their earnings in taxes. He says he wants to use that money to support working class families and cut the deficit. And he also pushed to expand the child tax credit. And he pointed to what he is doing to bring the cost of medications down. Last year's State of the Union got a bit rowdy with some Republicans heckling the president. So ahead of this speech, the House Speaker Mike Johnson said that he had sent a very clear message to House members telling them, quote, to turn the temperature down and basically refrain from heckling. Did it work? All right, Moshe, what did you think of the speech and the Republican reaction?
So, Jill, it was another rowdy State of the Union address. You had Marjorie Taylor Greene greeting President Biden with a MAGA hat. He reacted funnily to that as he was walking down that main aisle last night. I'll get into the exchange they had in just a little bit here. There were a couple points during the speech, if you were watching, where Republicans yelled out at him, some yelling lies, a lot of sparring. And honestly, it felt like the president last night was particularly comfortable with that, very comfortable with it. Here's a bit of it as Biden was talking about making the rich pay more when it comes to taxes to cut down on the national debt, to cut down on the deficit. Take a listen to how he ad-libbed back and forth with Republicans in the crowd.
Not fair. We have two ways to go. Republicans can cut Social Security and give more tax breaks to the wealthy. That's the proposal. Oh, no. You guys don't want another $2 trillion tax cut? I kind of thought that's what your plan was. Well, that's good to hear. You're not going to cut another $2 trillion for the super wealthy. That's good to hear. I'll protect and strengthen Social Security and make the wealthy pay their fair share.
So that's just an example of the more than hour-long speech, the energy level Biden had last night. Remember, he had multiple challenges last night, as we laid out on the podcast yesterday. Number one, he's got to convince Americans to let him continue to drive the car for 4 more years, let him keep the keys, and then also lay out where he's taken them for 4 years and where he'll take them for another 4 years. But first and foremost, it was about proving to Americans, including Democrats who've been worried of late, that the 81-year-old, already the oldest president in American history, is up to the challenge of running this country for another 4 years. A lot of adrenaline. He appeared well-rested last night, energized. And the first rule last night was don't mess up. Do not show your age. And besides a couple really minor stumbles, he had a very high energy level to the point where Republicans, who typically mock him as Sleepy Joe, Joe with dementia, were saying, what drugs did they give him? He was out of control last night. That was the criticism that Republicans gave him. So as far as performance is concerned, you know, I think there's a lot of Democrats this morning who are breathing a sigh of relief last night. By the way, I should mention, we did a live last night on our Mo News Premium Instagram account where some people were asking me, where has this guy been for 3 years? And what I said to them was, he's been around. You've seen glimmers of this, moments of this. But when it's day in, day out, he does get tired. And so you don't see the Joe Biden that you saw last night on a day-to-day basis. Back to the speech, though. You know, we talked about the taunting Republicans with ad libs here. There was another point where he was talking about immigration. He was heckled by a few Republicans, and he responded with another ad lib off of the planned remarks. Look at the facts. I know you know how to read. So a pretty vigorous performance overall. As far as the content, Biden made a very aggressive case last night for a second term in the White House. He used a speech to contrast himself with Trump, but never mentioned Trump's name, actually. That was notable. He would refer to him as his predecessor or as the former president. But it was very clear that he had Trump top of mind, and he made multiple examples of him during the speech. He began by laying out the stakes here. It was clear that he spent some time over the weekend with historian John Meacham, and he compared 2024 to 1941, saying democracy is under threat here at home and abroad. Right out of the gate, he was urging Congress to pass the $60 billion package for Ukraine. Again, comparing this to 1941, which is when Hitler was on the march in Europe, U.S. allies in need, and he's saying now is again the time where U.S. allies are in need and we need to support him. He then transitioned here at home, saying democracy is under threat here at home. January 6th, Trump remarks about being a dictator, election denying. A reminder here to everyone listening, Biden keeps a note card on him of all the things Trump has said as a daily reminder of the stakes here. It's one of the reasons Biden says he's running. He genuinely feels that democracy is on the verge of collapsing if Donald Trump is reelected here. So that was part of his message as he framed everything last night. Remember, he had multiple challenges last night. He had to speak to what he's done, what he's doing, show his energy level, assuage the concerns of liberals, progressives, young voters who are not very energized by Joe Biden right now, but also hit centrists, moderates, suburban women, Nikki Haley voters. So he had a lot of challenges last night that he tried to hit. He tried to hit kitchen table issues like shrinkflation, the economy, student loans, talk about his accomplishments the last 4 years. And then he, in the latter part of the speech, got to some of the challenges he's facing, including the border and immigration. And there he's been handed a opportunity by Republicans. Remember, you know, Biden didn't take the issue seriously for a long time. Republicans hit him hard over it. But then when the compromise came out in the last couple of months out of the Senate with Republicans and Democrats working together, Biden's like, all right, let's take immigration seriously here. Let's do something about the border. Republicans have refused to do anything. It's an election year. They say, Biden, you're on your own at this time. Trump is, by the way, pushing his fellow Republicans not to do anything, saying, wait till I get in office, we'll do something even better. He says, in the meantime, there's a challenge here. So Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I mentioned at the top, greeted Biden at the top with her MAGA hat, but also a pin with Laken Riley's photo on it. Laken Riley is the woman we told you about on this podcast, the 22-year-old Georgia nursing student who was murdered by a Venezuelan who crossed the border illegally into the U.S. So many Republicans have taken that up as an issue, showing that Biden, literally Biden's border, they say, has allowed in illegals who are murdering Americans. So she said, say her name, say her name. So she was shouting at Biden during the speech. Biden, in an ad-lib moment, he actually held up the pin that Marjorie Taylor Greene gave him, mentioning her name, Laken Riley, talking about the tragedy. Take a listen to a bit of what he did in that exchange with Marjorie Taylor Greene. Again, Biden at the podium. Republicans in the crowd.
Laken Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right. But how many of the thousands of people being killed by illegals? To her parents, I say, my heart goes out to you, having lost children myself. I understand. But look, if we change the dynamic at the border, I would respectfully suggest my Republican friends owe it to the American people, get this bill done. We need to act now.
So he's using this issue now to hit Republicans on immigration. He feels he can make the argument that, sure, we're taking it seriously. It's Republicans who aren't taking it seriously anymore. So this is going to be an issue. Continue to hear Biden saying again, you know, his heart goes out. But there's also many more Americans who are dying from legal Americans, from fellow Americans, from murder. As Republicans try to emphasize migrant crime, that's an issue that Trump now brings up at every campaign stop. A couple other notes here as he addressed a variety of subjects. Notable what he said last night on Israel and Gaza. He issued a very sharp directive to Israel's leaders. This is the most he's spoken about the Palestinians and the humanitarian situation in a public setting, saying to the leadership of Israel, I say this, humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority, as he laid out a bit of what he has planned to help in Gaza. We'll get to that in just the next story here. Now, he did really try to ride the line here, talking about what happened October 7th, talking about the murder of civilians, talking about Hamas, talking about Israel's right to defend itself. But then he really made a point here, and you see this as a response to what we've been seeing with progressives and now nearly half the Democratic Party that feels that he's been too friendly to Israel here with his rhetoric last night, really talking about the humanitarian situation, the dire circumstances that some Palestinians find themselves in. Again, talking about the victims here on both sides. So that I found really notable last night and was a change in rhetoric for the president. A couple more things before we go here, Jill. George Santos, your eyes were not deceiving you. He was back last night. It turns out that as a former member of Congress, you can attend the State of the Union. And despite the fact that he was literally kicked out by his fellow members, he showed up last night with a diamond encrusted collar. He was talking to Lauren Boebert. He was talking to Marjorie Taylor Greene. He took a seat. Eventually was told, this is for, you know, current members, go stand in the back. And Santos went to go stand in the back. A couple fashion statements that got noticed last night. A lot of the Democratic women were wearing white suits. That's been something they've done for a couple years now. It's in honor of the women suffragists 100 years ago. They all wore white as they fought for the women's right to vote. They started wearing it during Trump's years. Tonight, they said they were wearing white for reproductive freedom, believing that it's under attack with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, IVF, which, by the way, is something Biden mentioned last night. He made a point of having a woman from Alabama who conceived her baby through IVF. That's going to be a big thing for Democrats this cycle, as they talk about abortion, as they talk about IVF. So that's why you saw a lot of Democratic women wearing white last night. You also saw a number of members of Congress wearing blue suits. That's for Israel, and also yellow ribbons for the hostages, the Israeli hostages being held right now in the Gaza Strip.
Okay, now to the Middle East and also some news from Biden's State of the Union. The U.S. military is looking to build a temporary port on Gaza's coastline, a way to deliver large shipments of humanitarian aid by sea.
I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day.
That was a bit of what President Biden had to say last night, again in his State of the Union address. Part of his orders to flood the zone with aid by air, land, and now sea. The port will have a temporary pier and allow for hundreds of additional truckloads of assistance each day. Officials say this will not require any American troops to be on the ground in Gaza. U.S. military personnel will be present on the vessels offshore while the pier is being built. And it will take a number of weeks for that temporary pier to not only be built, but to be operational. That's according to U.S. officials. And they say there are hopes that the port will turn into a commercially operated facility over time. Israel has said it fully supports the creation of such a facility. And it comes as the humanitarian crisis in Gaza continues to get worse, with many of the 2.3 million Palestinians in the region facing a severe hunger crisis. Also, the White House said that Israel agreed to open a third road crossing into Gaza, which would particularly help the situation in northern Gaza, where the UN says the threat of famine is looming.
Yeah, right now the situation is particularly bad in the north. That's where there's an estimated 300,000 people living there that have been reduced to eating animal food to survive. The UN says now 1 in 6 children younger than 2 years old in that area suffers from acute malnutrition. This is a widening humanitarian crisis with the war now in its 5th month. And it's been pure chaos for a variety of reasons, getting aid in there by road. There's restrictions Israel's putting on it. And then there's the chaos that unfolds once aid gets in there, trucks being looted, gangs taking them over, Hamas fighters taking over these trucks, etc. So it's just been a dire situation. They've been trying airdrops in recent days, and now they're looking to create this sea bridge of sorts between the island of Cyprus and Gaza. Again, the U.S. hoping they can get that up and running in just the next few weeks here. As far as the ceasefire, that's been negotiated for a number of weeks. They've set effectively a deadline of the Ramadan holiday, which starts this weekend. There was a hope that as Muslims head into their holy month, that they could come to a ceasefire here, at least a temporary one. That's what they've been pushing. That's what the Israelis have agreed to. Hamas, though, sent a statement on Thursday. They're not happy with the deal. They left negotiations in Egypt. They say they will continue to consult here. What Hamas is looking for is a permanent ceasefire. The Israelis are offering a 6-week ceasefire, saying we can then use that time to negotiate a potential deal that goes further. Hamas saying, no, we want a permanent ceasefire. We want all Israeli troops to leave the Gaza Strip. We want all Gazans to be able to return home. We also want a very large number. It is unclear how many. Number of prisoners, including convicted terrorists who have committed murder, to be released from Israeli prison. Some of those a non-starter for the Israeli government. So the talks will continue into next week. And it comes as there's an apparent rift between Hamas leaders. There's the Hamas leaders, the billionaires who live in Doha, Qatar. And then there's the Hamas leadership, Yahya Sinwar, who launched the war October 7th in Gaza. Apparently, Sinwar is saying, we don't need to give them a deal. I'm okay with the status quo continuing, the war continuing, whereas you have the leaders outside the country saying, please take the deal. We can, you know, then use the next 6 weeks to negotiate something further. Back in Gaza, Sinwar actually thinks the number of Palestinian casualties and deaths are working to his advantage. He's also hoping that as Ramadan starts and you have tens of millions of Muslim men across the Arab world go to mosque and hear various sermons, etc., that could stir up more violence, more anger, and more loyalty to the Palestinian cause. So he's trying to strategically, Sinwar is, strategically play the holiday to his favor. Keep in mind, Ramadan, notably, is a very holy month, but at the same time has been a time where you've seen an upsurge in terror attacks and violence across the region on a variety of factors, whether you could go back to Afghanistan, Iraq, of course, in the Palestinian territories and in Jerusalem as well, escalating tensions right now. So that's something to bear in mind. And also one of the reasons you heard both the U.S. and a number of Arab governments say now for weeks that they were very much hoping to get a deal by Ramadan because of the fear of dealing with potential protests, out of control protests on the streets in the coming days. All right, we have a lot more news to get to, including today's speed read. But first, I want to thank our big sponsor this week, Factor Meals. We're definitely pressed for time in our house, and I still want to eat healthy, nutritious meals. And that's why I'm so excited about Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service. The thing about Factor is you can pick your meals. They get delivered to your door. You put them in the fridge, and typically you can heat them up in a couple minutes, and they're ready to go. And they're not just your, you know, parents' frozen meals from the grocery store. They are chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I've been loving them lately. I take them to work with me to the Mo News headquarters, and they often serve as my lunch. You get to skip, you know, preparing meals or the more expensive, you know, delivery or picking up a sandwich around the corner. And so there's the convenience factor, the cost factor, but also the nutritional factor. You get the nutritional quality you need. There's 35 plus weekly meals to choose from. It's flexible. You get as many meals as you want, as few meals as you want, and you can also pause and reschedule deliveries at any time. So check them out, factormeals.com/monews50. Again, that is factor, F-A-C-T-O-R, meals.com, factormeals.com/monews50 for 50% off. Again, that is 50% off. I definitely think it's worth a try.
Time now for the speed read from CNN. A U.S. House committee advanced a bill Thursday that could lead to a nationwide ban against TikTok on all electronic devices. And it comes as there are ongoing concerns that TikTok could pose a Chinese government spying risk here in the United States. The measure sailed unanimously through the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and it will next come up for a vote by the full U.S. House. The bill would ban TikTok from U.S. app stores unless the social media platform, used by about 50% of the country, about 170 million Americans, is quickly spun off from its China-linked parent company, ByteDance. If enacted, the bill would give ByteDance 165 days, or a little more than 5 months, to sell TikTok. If not divested by that date, it would be illegal for app store operators like Apple and Google to make it available for download. The bill also contemplates similar prohibitions for other apps that are, quote, controlled by foreign adversary companies. So, Moshe, it's still not clear if this actually were to pass, what this would mean for the 170 million Americans who already have the app downloaded onto their phone, but clearly a big deal for people who do not have it yet.
Yeah, which, by the way, the numbers are striking, right? One out of two Americans, literally half of America, has the TikTok app at this point. There has been this push in recent weeks for this ban again. Remember, it is banned on federal government devices. A number of states have also banned it for state government devices. But this would be the most aggressive legislation targeting TikTok so far to come out of Congress. This comes as the CEO of TikTok recently testified to lawmakers that the app poses no threat to Americans. But again, it's very unclear the relationship that ByteDance has with the Chinese government. And that is what is concerning lawmakers here. TikTok is mounting a major push against this bill, as again, it came out of a House committee, has to go to the full U.S. House, but also have to go to the full U.S. Senate, then go to President Biden as well. TikTok says that this bill strips, quote, 170 million Americans of their constitutional right to free expression. This will damage millions of businesses, destroy the livelihoods of countless creators across the country, and deny artists an audience. Speaking to reporters, Gallagher, the congressman, rejected characterizations that this is a ban. He says this is not a ban. This puts the choice squarely in the hands of TikTok to sever their relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. Remember, going back to the Trump days, effectively, this was the deal that was being negotiated during his administration to get ByteDance to sell off TikTok. Those negotiations were happening with a number of companies. Walmart was interested at one point. Oracle was interested. Microsoft was interested. And so this basically returns us to sort of where we were at in 2019 going into 2020. So TikTok is telling all of its followers, dial your members of Congress, express your opposition to the bill. Congressional staffers are already saying they are flooded with phone calls right now by this TikTok campaign, by TikTok users across the country who are saying, do not pass this legislation. So CNN reports that there are calls coming from teenagers, not surprisingly, but also coming from the elderly, some of whom seem to be confused about why they're calling or why TikTok might be at risk, but were so convinced by the messages and emails they were getting that they called Congress to say, don't ban TikTok. I think in some cases it might be grandparents who are advocating on behalf of their grandchildren, but that anecdote particularly amusing. I don't know why I'm calling you, but please don't do
that. What is TikTok? Whatever it is, do not ban it.
Do not ban it. I'm told it's good. They're telling me it's good, and it's going to be bad if you ban it. Jill, again, just take people through the process. This goes to the full U.S. House. You got to have a majority there. The majority of Republicans, by the way, are in favor of this, and some Democrats, too. So you can imagine this gets through the House. Senate is where things typically slow down, and they actually try to take a pause on things and think through them, and they might hold hearings to figure that out. You bring up a good point when it comes to what happens to all of us who have TikTok on their phone, right? I have TikTok on my phone. Mo News has a TikTok account. So what happens to the existing users, and also the App Store is how you get updates. So how would you get updates sent to the app as well? Would that be blocked by this? So a lot of questions as we look around the world. The most significant ban on TikTok is over in India, where its population, the most populous country on earth, 1.5 billion people, do not have access to TikTok. Nepal, smaller country to its north, banned TikTok last year, saying it, quote, disturbs social harmony in the country. And then Taiwan, again, given the tensions with China, is another country that bans TikTok. But for the most part, beyond that, the U.S. is like these other couple dozen countries, which currently just bans it on government devices.
It is fascinating, though. I'm glad you mentioned that this is basically the same deal that was on the table during the Trump administration. And as you mentioned, Walmart potentially was going to buy TikTok. So it'll be interesting to see what names pop up this time around, if Walmart is still interested. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, that was a deal that Oracle and Walmart were going to partner together to own TikTok. And by the way, as you look at Walmart, they're competing with Amazon. Amazon has Amazon Prime. So as these companies look at, you know, video and content, that made sense then. 4 years later, it's a good question. First of all, whether ByteDance would even consider this 4 years later, given that they had to do the song and dance last time, and how vital they view the U.S. market, and frankly, how serious Congress ends up being, and legally, whether this stands, because again, it appears TikTok is trying to make a First Amendment fight here.
Okay, from NBC News, two Alabama fertility clinics that paused IVF services last month expect to resume them now that the state lawmakers have passed a bill this week. The new law, signed by the governor late Wednesday, protects doctors and clinics that discard embryos as part of routine IVF services. Several facilities suspended IVF services February 22nd after the state Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos are considered unborn children. One Alabama fertility clinic that does about 10 egg retrievals and 10 frozen embryo transfers per week is opening back up, and they estimate about 40 patients may not have received promised care during that pause in IVF services.
Yeah, it appears the clinics here are split. A couple say, okay, with this new law, we're ready to go. A couple not so sure yet. The bill that passed Wednesday offers civil and criminal immunity to doctors, clinics, and healthcare personnel who provide IVF, but it does not clarify whether under state law, frozen embryos created via IVF and not yet implanted have the same rights as children. And that was a key issue here. This law, again, just deals with immunity, not the underlying are frozen embryos children. So after the court ruling, IVF providers were concerned that they could face legal repercussions for getting rid of embryos. That is a common part of IVF because some embryos have genetic abnormalities or are no longer needed. So again, you have some that are restarting and others that say they're not ready to start services. That includes the Center for Reproductive Medicine in Mobile, Alabama. They say, quote, we believe the new law falls short of addressing the fertilized eggs currently stored across the state and leaves challenges for physicians and clinics trying to help deserving families have children of their own. So Republicans in the state were very much under pressure to get IVF restarted again, given how unpopular it was that everything was effectively frozen here. And it appears some clinics still have some legal concerns, given how haphazard this new law was passed. Remember, that's something that the court in Alabama said about the first law, saying, you guys haven't gone into enough detail here. We have issues with it, hence why we ruled the way we did. And now they've tried to do this immediate fix on immunity, and there are questions about that.
From NBC News, lung cancer rates are dropping for every group except non-smoking Asian American women, for whom they're actually increasing by about 2% per year. This is according to a California study. While lung cancer is traditionally associated with cigarettes, as many as 20% of U.S. cases happen in never smokers every year. Among Asian American women who have lung cancer, more than 50% have never smoked. And for Chinese and Indian American women who have lung cancer, the non-smoking percentage rises to 80 to 90%. Scientists are baffled by this pattern, and it has led to a recent surge of research. In two ongoing blockbuster studies at the University of California, San Francisco, and NYU, they have been searching for reasons why Asian American women are at especially high risk and for ways to catch their tumors earlier. Doctors are working to reform the screening guidelines to better include Asian American women.
So to date, studies of female non-smokers in Asia have identified risk factors like cooking oil fumes, secondhand smoke, air pollution, and indoor heating with coal, but no research has focused specifically on Asian American women. Though there was a study a couple years ago that found that Asian Americans breathe in 73% more tiny pollution particles than white Americans, most likely due to where they live, industry, vehicle emissions, and construction. And there's also just a data shortage here, and that could be one of the issues. Asian Americans are often lumped into the other category of race, and that obscures their data here. There's also an NBC story I was reading, Jill, about how private a lot of Asian American women are with their health. And so that's an issue. So as we look at these numbers, keep in mind they can only go with the data that they have, and they are trying to seek out more data to get a better sense of what's happening here.
From NPR, a jury in New Mexico has found Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the armorer for the film Rust, guilty of involuntary manslaughter. During the criminal trial, prosecutors successfully argued that her negligence and recklessness led to the death of the film's cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, back in 2021. Hutchins was behind the camera when she was shot by a gun being held by actor Alec Baldwin while she was setting up a shot for the Western movie. A bullet killed her and it wounded the director of the film. Prosecutors say that Gutierrez Reed was to blame for unwittingly bringing at least one live round of ammunition that was loaded into what was supposed to be a prop gun. They argued that she flouted basic safety protocols for handling weapons on the film set. The special prosecutor saying this is not a case where Hannah Gutierrez made one mistake. This case is about constant, never-ending safety failures that resulted in the death of a human being and nearly killed another. And she said that even though Baldwin was holding the gun that went off, it was the armorer's job to say to him, an A-list actor, hey, you cannot behave that way with those firearms.
In her defense, her attorney was saying that she was unfairly scapegoated here for the shooting, a victim of sabotage, that there was a production company on a shoestring budget, an A-list actor calling the shots. She was young, in her mid-20s, and effectively they've all now pointed the finger at her as the person to blame, and it wasn't her fault. The argument, again, from the other side, from the prosecution, is that she was a mess, that the way that she dealt with the gun, with the bullets, with the ammunition, was a disaster. And there was a mix here of the dummy bullets and live ammunition. Again, she denies being a source of the live ammunition, but an investigation afterwards found six rounds, found six bullets, live bullets there, and one of them was loaded into that gun. A jury heard testimony by FBI experts in firearms and crime scene forensics that broke down what they think took place. The film's firearm supplier said they never supplied the live rounds to the film crew. So it still remains a mystery how these live rounds got there. But sadly, they got into the gun. That's the gun that killed Helena Hutchins. I should note that she did not testify in the trial, but she says that when she handed Alec Baldwin the gun that day, that she checked for signs that all the bullets in there were inert, but then acknowledged in a previous deposition that she probably should have checked them again. She now faces 18 months in prison. She'll face sentencing a little bit later this year. And Alec Baldwin himself is also facing charges. He's going to be facing a trial here coming up July 9th. He faces charges of involuntary manslaughter, though he has pleaded not guilty, saying he had nothing to do with the loading of the gun. He also maintains he did not pull the trigger, though some experts say that the gun could not have gone off without him pulling the trigger since it was in his hand. And that's something we'll learn more about when that trial begins this summer.
And from NBC News, the movie industry rolling out the red carpet for the 96th Academy Awards. That ceremony is set to be televised live on ABC starting at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific time. That is earlier than usual on Sunday. What to expect? Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, about the race to build the atomic bomb during World War II, leads the pack of contenders with 13 nods. This year's other major nominees include Barbie, Killers of the Flower Moon, and Poor Things. Jimmy Kimmel is hosting for the fourth time. And 10 movies are up for Best Picture this year: American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, and The Zone of Interest. How many of those have you seen, Moshe?
I have seen Oppenheimer and Barbie. Jill, yourself?
Samesy.
Right. It was the year of Barbenheimer, and at least we both got to them. I ended up watching Oppenheimer on streaming. I do want to see Killers of the Flower Moon. I mean, I'd love to see Maestro. I'd love to see a few of these. Jill, it's tough with the kids, you know?
I hear you.
So if you've been watching this award season, Oppenheimer has been crushing it. So they are considered a lock for Best Picture. We'll see if there's any surprises, though. I'm told Davine Randolph is expected to win Best Supporting Actress for The Holdovers. Haven't seen that film. But apparently the other three acting races are not as predictable, according to the folks who are closely watching this. There is some money being put on Cillian Murphy of Oppenheimer for Best Actor, Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon for Best Actress, and Robert Downey Jr., also of Oppenheimer, for Best Supporting Actor. If Lily Gladstone wins for Best Actress, she would become the first Native American person to win a competitive acting Oscar in the entire history of the Oscars. So that's something, the history there, that we'll be watching for on Sunday evening. We told you when the nominations came out, a lot was made of the snubs. Greta Gerwig, Margot Robbie, the director and star of Barbie, not being nominated for Best Director and Best Actress. But they both could still win Oscars Sunday night. Gerwig is nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, along with her husband, Noah Baumbach. And Margot Robbie, by the way, is listed as a producer for Barbie. So if that film wins, she could win an Oscar via that award. There's going to be a lot of A-list presenters. Jill, typically this award show goes on for, what, 5-6 hours sometimes. The Oscars are known for being extremely long. Bad Bunny, Dwayne Johnson, Kate McKinnon, John Mulaney, Rami Youssef, Zendaya, Steven Spielberg, Melissa McCarthy, all among those who will be presenting, according to the reports right now. And Ryan Gosling apparently is going to be performing I'm Just Ken. So look out for that.
I'm just Ken. Anywhere else, I'd be a 10. I think that's the line. The Oscars, by the way, are making a big deal of the fact that they're starting an hour earlier at 7 p.m. instead of 8 p.m. I guess because, you know, these award shows, as you mentioned, do tend to go long. So it's a way to ensure that people are able to watch the end, which is the big award for best film.
It's also a way to ensure that when we record the update to this podcast at midnight on Sunday night, going into Monday, that we're doing it slightly earlier. Jill, are you going to stay up with me?
TBD, Moshe. TBD. We will have daylight longer, so perhaps I will. All right, it is Friday. Cheers to the freaking weekend. Time for what we are watching, reading, and eating. Moshe, what will you be watching?
Jill, we just talked about it, the Oscars. I'll be watching that on Sunday night. One interesting trend line we've been watching, it wasn't that long ago that the Oscars used to get 30 to 40 million viewers, and now it's dropped below 10 million, down to 6 or 7 million. So I'll be interested to see whether, now that we're a couple years post-COVID, whether the viewership starts to return to the Oscars, if they're able to pull off what the Grammys pulled off this year. One of the things I'm watching. Jill, what are you watching?
All right, Moshe, I do believe in honesty here. So I'm watching the Housewives reunions. Miami and Beverly Hills Housewives all have their reunions going on. My husband cringes whenever he comes into the bedroom and it's on, but it is my guilty pleasure.
So. But does he then stick around? Does he stick around and keep
watching?
No,
he doesn't. He really, it's like his kryptonite. Okay. He cannot be in the room when it's on.
Because like there's hate watching. Like some people hate it, but then keep watching.
No, he's just like, I can't take this. And he actually will go into another room. But any Housewives fans out there, message me because I absolutely love talking about the drama as if these people are in my actual life. Moshe, what are you reading?
Jill, I just finished up The Big Fail by Bethany McLean. It's a deep dive into what took place over the last 5 years with COVID, what everybody got wrong. It goes after Fauci. It goes after Trump. It goes after Cuomo. It goes after DeSantis. It goes after Newsom. Really, everybody. And, you know, while many of us want to move beyond COVID and pandemic for obvious reasons, there are a lot of lessons to learn from what we got wrong, especially the lockdowns. And so I found the book fascinating as somebody who lived and breathed it. The reason why Mo News exists is because we started during the lockdown. And so found it fascinating and just had a chance to interview Bethany. And we have that interview right now over on the Premium podcast. So if you're not a member of Mo News Premium, that's where you get weekend news on Instagram all weekend long. We'll have some Oscars coverage on Sunday over there. We do deep dives. We do Ask Me Anythings. I went live there for the State of the Union. And then we also have the Premium pod. So join today, mo.news/premium. Jill, what are you reading?
I'm reading a piece in The Atlantic. It is called The Golden Age of American Jews is Ending. Anti-Semitism on the right and the left threatens to bring a close to an unprecedented period of safety and prosperity for Jewish Americans and demolish the liberal order that they helped establish. It is a long read for a news article anyway, but I do think it captures the feeling that a lot of American Jews have right now, which is that perhaps for the first time ever, America may not be the safe haven that they envisioned. Moshe, I am a big comment reader, and the comments are highly anti-Semitic, which I think reinforces the article.
Jill, that's also on my reading list, and look forward to breaking it down over on the Instagram page for everyone next week.
Okay, Moshe, in much lighter news, what are we eating? You're in Florida. Tell us what you guys are doing.
Jill, it's Friday. It's Friday. Let's lighten things up at the end here. Tried to get out to a couple of the restaurants down here. Many of you have been very kind in making recommendations. Alex, my wife, is very good at finding some of the newer places out there. So very excited to try some places that have also been around for a while here. Some of our favorites. We're getting to Bay Bay in Miami, Motec in Aventura, and got to enjoy a meal at Biblos, one of my favorites in Miami this week. So trying to enjoy the Miami food scene while we're down here. Jill, what's cooking out in Long Island?
Okay. Fluffy cottage cheese pancakes. They're very high in protein. They're made with clean ingredients. I actually found the recipe on Instagram. It's from Ambitious Kitchen.
The recipe found you on Instagram.
Basically, no, that's actually true, right? Yeah. It came up. They know me. They know the things I'm looking for. So they basically, they taste like banana bread and are genuinely easy to make, which a lot of recipes claim that they're easy to make and then have like 100 steps. These legit took less than 10 minutes. I posted the recipe in our newsletter, but I'll also post it on my Instagram, which is Jill R. Wagner. So follow me there and I will give you this recipe. You will not be disappointed. I have to say they're amazing. My son loves them. My daughter, not so much, but you know, she just doesn't like anything.
If you ever have a recipe that takes less than 10 minutes, send to Jill.
Yes. All right, guys. Thank you for listening to the Mo News podcast. If you like what you hear, please share this with your friends. It will help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and review us in the App Store.
The reviews make a difference. We appreciate it. Keep spreading the word about Mo News, all our platforms, about the podcast especially. Especially after we saw that Instagram outage this week. We're building a home here in the audio space because you never quite know what happens in the social media land. So appreciate all of you who have found us here, who keep spreading the word. A lot of exciting things in store that we'll be able to make announcements on soon in regards to the podcast.
And Moshe, have fun at the first ever Mo News meetup in Miami.
Yeah, we're doing a Mo News Premium meetup. If you wanted another reason to join Mo News Premium, and we try to keep giving you new reasons to join Mo News Premium, we're doing in-person meetups for the premium members. And we're beginning in Miami this evening, 5 o'clock down near Miami Beach, but not so close to Miami Beach that you got to deal with the spring breakers. We kept it slightly away from that area. But if you're looking for the details, join Premium, and they're posted over on the Premium Instagram account.
Moshe, feel free to FaceTime me. I will be around.
We will, Jill. People have asked, like, is Jill going to be there? And I'm like, She will not be. But Jill, I asked on the premium account, where do you guys want to see the next Mo News Premium meetup? And I noticed your answer was very convenient to you. People are like, come to Nashville, come to Salt Lake City, come to LA. Jill's answer was, come to Long Island.
You asked, Moshe. I'm just being honest.
Listen, you're right. You're right, Jill. Like, that makes sense. You should want to do a meetup in Long Island. In fact, We will do one soon, since you live there and I don't live very far away.
All right, guys, have a great weekend. Good luck with the time change, and we'll see you back here on Monday.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News Podcast.